Baby, Cherie says carefully.
Right. You know, miniature human, demanding little critters that expect everyone to wait on them hand and foot. Are you the proud new mama?
Charisse looks nothing short of horrified, and I restrain a shuddering sigh of relief.
There's no baby here, the father snaps. You think we're fool enough to have one in winter?
Or fool enough to have one at all? Layla says. I'd like a baby someday, the youngest says, her voice soft. But not now.
I want to drop the matter here. See? There's been a terrible mistake, and these are not the parents. Yet I hear the father's words and wonder what would happen if one of the girls did give birth in winter. Edwin mentioned abandonment. That's what people used to do, whether it was a baby or an infirm relative, when winter came with no extra rations to sustain the week. If that is the case, then I need to know that I can stop searching. Fine, you abandoned your baby, and now we have it and may proceed with whatever option we choose. However, if Abby's mother is still out there, I need to keep looking. I'm struggling for a way to get a definitive answer when Cypher says,
See, that's what I was wondering. I told Casey and Eric that if you folks did have a winter baby, you might be willing to part with it. But since you don't...
When I realize what he's saying, I flinch. The words have barely left his mouth before Charisse pounces.
You want a baby? She says to me.
We're not, I begin.
If you had one, she might be willing to pay,
Cypher says.
But since you don't...
We can fix that, she says. Make us an offer, and me and Owen will consider giving you a baby.
Unless the problem is the cowboy,
Owen says.
Which I'm sure it is. In that case, I can fix it for you.
He winks at me, and I tense, my gaze shooting to Charisse. But she only says,
For a price, he will. I'm not giving you free access to my man.
Unless the problem's yours, Layla says. In which case, I'll help. For the right price, of course.
Jesus,
Cypher mutters.
You won't get in here, Missy? Offer to rent out your baby-making body parts, too?
The youngest shakes her head, her gaze lowered, and I shoot Cypher a look to back off her. He frowns, as if genuinely baffled. We aren't in the market for a baby, I say. Ty's beating around the bush here, and I appreciate his discretion, but it's leading to a serious misunderstanding. We found a baby, a little boy left in the woods. He seems to have been abandoned, but we want to be absolutely certain there isn't a family frantically looking for him before we send him down south for adoption. Layla's mouth opens, and I know she's about to claim that, whoops, yes, she totally forgot about that baby she left in the forest. Charisse beats her to it with a more measured,
All right, it is possible that we had a winter-born child. If we didn't say so, it's because we don't need your judgment. You have no concept of a life where horrible choices must be made.
Like leaving a baby to die of cold,
Dalton says.
Or be ripped apart by predators, instead of just suffocating him mercifully. Also,
a pointed glance around their well-stocked camp, complete with storage facilities.
I could tell you folks are hard up for supplies. I have no idea how you'll get through the winter.
Charisse glares at him. Don't presume to understand our choices. I thought I had suffocated the child, but clearly I was too distraught to do it properly. Dalton's mouth opens, and I know he's going to tell her to cut the crap, but a look from me stops him. I must admit I'm impressed by Charisse's performance, but dragging this out isn't going to help anyone. So you bore a son, I say. I'm sure I say it with complete calm, and certainly the others don't react. But by now, I've realized their father is patriarch in name only. I sense that the real power lies in a nearby grave, her position taken over by Charisse, who sees the trap in my words.
Did you say son? She says carefully. A boy?
She's gauging my reaction as carefully as I'm gauging hers, like prize fighters in the ring trying to anticipate the next blow and react accordingly. I could gamble here. I don't need to, though. I shrug and say, Okay, you got me. It's a girl. She leans back.
Of course it is. I know my own child. I take my backpack, dump the water from my canteen, and hold it out. I'll need proof. Her face screws up. Proof that she's yours, I say. Proof that you're a nursing mother. Layla bursts out laughing. Cherie swings on her so fast, the next thing I see is blood in the snow, and then Layla cupping her nose. She didn't make a sound, only glares at Cherie before dropping her eyes in submission. Cherie's gaze turns on Missy. I expect the youngest to look away fast, but she holds her sister's gaze with a level, open stare. Not challenging her, but not backing down either. Cherie snorts, and it's an animal sound, the alpha accepting that no threat is forthcoming and leaving the younger one be.
That's enough, girls,
their father says, and it is the voice of every parent who doesn't want to seem as if he's lost control of his children. The girls ignore him. They're already settling in after their scuffle. So the baby isn't from here, I say. That's all I wanted to know. However, if you have any idea who she does belong to, and you're correct, we'll pay for that information.
$200 worth of goods,
Dalton says.
Tell us what you want, and I'll get it in Dawson or Whitehorse.
The patriarch's eyes glitter.
Alcohol. That's liquid gold out here, especially this time of year.
We'll take some alcohol, Cherie says, among other things. And we want $1,000 worth.
First, you need to get us the information,
Dalton says.
Then we need to confirm it. Then you can choose between $200 from your shopping list or $400 from ours.
$500. Dalton looks at me. He's not verifying the amount. With my bank account, that's pocket change. He's seeing if I have any restrictions or limitations to add. I pet Storm and casually say, we have a doctor in town who will examine the mother, to be sure she gave birth at the time the baby was born. Of course, there's no way to be quite that specific, but these aren't medical professionals. I continue. So if someone claims to be the mother in hopes of getting a reward, it'll be a waste of everyone's time. The mother must come to Rockton for the child. In other words, I don't want this family taking the mother captive and then calling us to deliver the cash. I add, and if the child was abandoned, we're fine with that. We won't judge the mother's choice, and we will make sure the baby goes to a good home. How much will you get for that? Cherie says. Paid adoptions are illegal in Canada. She snorts. Their laws are not our laws. If you sell the baby.
We won't,
Dalton says.
We may keep it or we may find a suitable home, but no cash will exchange hands. People aren't trade goods.
She rolls her eyes at her ridiculous scruples. This is a woman who was sold herself from a very young age. Probably, as I realize now, by her own mother. That practice hasn't stopped since their mother died. Cherie certainly was ready to see what she could get for me. I would like to say I can't wrap my head around that. How could you be sold yourself and then do the same to others? The truth is much more complex. Just ask anyone who was abused as a child and does the same to their own offspring. As we finish the negotiations, which is mostly closing any loopholes for Cherie to exploit, we're preparing to leave when the father says,
I'm glad we've reached an agreement here. I've always said that trade relations are important.
Dalton slowly turns but says nothing, waiting for what we both know is coming.
We'd be a valuable trade partner for Rockton,
the man says. He means that we'd be valuable to them. I see Dalton getting ready to make some sarcastic comment, but then he tightens his jaw and slides a look my way, tossing this grenade to me. That's an interesting proposition, I say. If this goes well, we could discuss it. I take off my pack and open it. We don't have a lot of need for trade supplies in Rockton, but there's always an interest in craftsmanship. We'd love work like this. I pull out the piece I'd cut from the dead woman's jacket. I'm not eager to open trade with this family, but if I was to hazard a guess on the artisan, I'd point at Missy. If she can create items that Rockton considers valuable, it might help her position here.
But when I show the piece, I get only blank expressions. Then Cherie says,
I don't have time for pretty sewing, but Missy might be able to do something like that.
Missy nods.
They say I do fine work with my tanning and my crafting.
She takes off her coat and passes it to me. It is indeed excellent, and I say so. But when I ask if she does anything decorative, she considers and then says,
those we trade with are looking for practical pieces, long-lasting and warm and pleasant to wear, soft furs and smooth leathers. They aren't interested in work such as that, so I haven't tried it, but I could, if you left that with me.
I say I will, though I assure her that Rockton is interested in general craftsmanship too. And while a little decoration would be appreciated, what she's already doing would also be valuable. Far more so than the meat or hides her family would otherwise provide. As for this work, I lift the piece and I'm ready to ask if they recognize the workmanship, but Cipher catches my eye and I stop before linking it to the baby. We'll deal with this family if that's our only way of finding Abby's mother, but I shouldn't provide clues to set them on our trail. I cut the piece in two and leave half with Missy, and we say our goodbyes. Storm and I walk in front, the guys behind, all of us quiet. Once we're far enough from the encampment, Cipher says,
that piece you were showing, you didn't just happen to be carrying that in your pack, did you?
It's from the dead woman. Edwin identified it as that family's work, and he said one of the girls was pregnant, so it all lined up.
You lied,
Dalton mutters.
Lied and sent us on a wild goose chase.
I think he was hoping to send us into a dead end, I say.
Tell us what we needed to conclude it was the baby of a family who shouldn't be raising one. We'd decide to keep Abby. Everyone's happy. Well, you know, except the actual mother. I shake my head. Sure, I get that he thinks we'd make good parents, but what about her?
He lied because he knows where that comes from,
Cipher says.
And he doesn't want you and Eric going there.
He glances at Dalton.
It's from the second settlement.
Chapter 28. There are two major settlements out here, both originating from Rockton. The first, and yes, the second. No reason to get fancy with names. The first is an actual settlement. It's been in the same place since Edwin led a group from Rockton. The second is more nomadic. They build semi-permanent residences, which they abandon when the food supply shifts. They'll also move if they feel at all threatened by trappers, miners, settlers, or hostiles. The second settlement does minimal outside trading, and that's a two-way street of paranoia. They don't like mingling with others, and others don't like mingling with them. Secretive and eccentric. That's what I'd call them. As for Cipher's opinion,
that shit fucking crazy,
he says as we walk.
You were telling me you think the hostiles are some kind of cult. If they are, they might have come from the second settlement, because those fuckers are a cult. Except they aren't the kind that recruits in shopping malls. Their doors are closed.
But you know them, I say.
Once upon a time, I was an exception to the rule, and the rule itself wasn't so much a rule as a general guideline. While they didn't throw open their doors to traders, they did business with a very select number of settlers. They picked me because I was sheriff when a group of them left Rockton. I let them go and sold the council a line of bullshit about how hard I looked for them. So, when I left Rockton, they invited me to trade. But then about 5 years back, they had a change in leadership and the doors swung shut.
Why did Edwin lie? I say. If they don't trade, he can't be worried about us opening a line of exchange with them.
You know Edwin,
Cipher says.
He's a crafty old bastard. He's hedging his bets here, protecting what's his. The second settlement doesn't hold a grudge against Rockton. If you go sniffing around,
he shrugs.
You and Eric make a good team. That's why Edwin's reopened that connection. They might talk shit about Eric, but he trusts him. Eric's a strong leader, tough and fair. He can be a pain in the ass to deal with, but you're not. You're the diplomat. If Edwin's opened that door for you too, the second settlement might too. Edwin doesn't want that. Also, the old man's got a nasty streak. Giving you their baby would warm the cockles of his heart all winter.
I'm not sure that last part's true. Edwin might really have presumed the winterborn baby had been abandoned. It's still a shitty thing to do. So where do we find them? I ask. Dalton jerks his chin east.
That way, almost a full day's walk. Yeah, I keep tabs on them. Never talk to them. I was raised not to. They made my birth parents nervous, so we steered clear. Jane Dalton wanted nothing to do with either settlement and advised me to do the same. But I always know where to find them. They've been over there for the last few years.
So back to town for the snowmobiles? I ask. Dalton shakes his head.
There aren't any trails out there. We gotta walk, which means going back to town and gearing up for a full-on camping trip. Why don't I head on back to Rockton? You kids overnight at my place,
Cipher says.
It's a hell of a lot closer than Rockton. If you strike out from there in the morning, you'll reach the second settlement by afternoon. You'll need to grab a tent overnight on the way back, but I've got one and plenty of blankets. Take what you need for my supplies.
He smiles.
That gives me permission to take what I need from yours.
Cipher leaves for Rockton, and by nightfall, we've made it to his winter cabin. It used to be owned by a settler named Silas Cox. Come winter, Cipher would rent a sleeping bag in the corner. Then Cox fell victim to the local cougar, and Cipher took over the lease. When spring arrives, he'll be on the move, following game and trading like Jacob. In winter, though, everyone wants a place to hunker down, and this is Cipher's. Since taking possession, he's made repairs. Cox had been the kind of guy who builds a half-assed structure and stays until it rots. Cipher has filled cracks between the logs, fixed the roof, and added a sturdy food storage compartment around back. When we get inside, we find as cozy a cabin as you could want. It's only about 10 by 15 feet, but out here, extra room means extra heating. The interior has a fireplace, an underfloor icebox, a low bed, and a table with one chair. Before we split from Cipher, he'd asked us to check his snares. Trapping is his preferred hunting method. He doesn't use guns and has never mastered a bow. We leave Storm inside with some dried meat and head out in the dark, flashlights in hand. The snares haven't been checked in 2 days, and we find 2 snowshoe hares, a marten and a mink. Dalton skins the marten and mink for Cipher. The meat is only eaten late in a cold, hard winter, and we presume Cipher won't want it, so we cook it up for Storm. What she doesn't eat, I'll dry in strips overnight in the fireplace, and we'll take it with us for her. I cook one of the hares for our dinner. We don't eat anything else with it. Cipher isn't a gardener, and 90% of his food stores are meat, so we won't raid his meager supply of dried greens, berries, nuts, and roots. We have a half dozen chocolate peanut butter protein bars in our packs and split one for dessert. We're in bed by 8. That's what can happen when night falls by late afternoon and you haven't slept more than a few hours in days. We don't sleep, though. No sex, either. It's been a long and unsettling day, and even after we crawl into bed, we don't talk about it right away. We've let Storm stay in the cabin. There's plenty of room. I curl up with Dalton, my cheek resting on his bare chest, listening to his slow breathing. Feeling the tension, too, strumming through him, and waiting for him to speak.
What happened today?
He says, finally.
With Owen and Charisse.
Trying to sell me? I say, my voice light. He's on his back, and I roll on top of him, my arms crossed on his chest. Owen came out first, and I had that situation under control, so I tried to defuse it rather than fight. I didn't expect Charisse. I purse my lips. Pretty sure no one expects Charisse. She is a piece of work. But I still wasn't in danger of being carted off like a side of venison. I was trying to keep things cool until... I remember and I shiver. I don't mean to. I can't help it. Under me, Dalton goes rigid.
What happened?
He says. Charisse happened, I say, again keeping my voice light.
I got a bit of a scare, but I want to fluff it off. But after a moment, I say, we'll need to keep an eye on her. She's smart as hell and twice as vicious. He nods, saying nothing, his nod tight as he holds in whatever he's thinking, whatever he wants to say. Eric, I say.
I'm concerned about Owen,
he says.
That's not underestimating Charisse. She's a fucking cobra. She's smart, though, like you said, so I get the sense she can be managed. Very, very carefully managed. With any luck, she'll decide she doesn't want to lose Rockton as a prospective trade partner. But Owen,
he exhales, breath hissing through his teeth.
The way he was looking at you.
Dalton makes a face.
I don't mean I'm jealous. None of that territorial bullshit. Men notice you. They pay attention. You don't pay attention back. If anyone tries anything, you take care of it. You don't need me to protect you. But Owen, fuck.
You know him.
Yeah.
What was he in Rockton for? Another exhale.
That's what I want to talk to you about. If I'm hesitating, it's just...
He waves his hands, gesturing, and I start to roll off, but he holds my hips.
It's the usual bullshit. This part of me that wants to smooth it over, pretend it's not that bad so I don't scare you off. I wouldn't do that. You need to know. I just...
Another helpless wave.
You were in the forest, playing with our dog, and a couple of psychos threatened to kidnap and sell you. That's fucking nuts. Then it's just another day out here, and it shouldn't be. Biggest thing you should need to worry about is the wildlife. But no, it's the crazy people who want to kill you, or now, apparently, sell you.
I laugh. I can't help it. It starts as a snicker, and then I'm sputtering, choking on laughter.
It's not funny, Casey,
he says. Oh, but it has to be, doesn't it? Otherwise, we'll become the crazy people. I settle in and look down at him. We're in the Yukon wilderness. There are people here for this lifestyle, like you and me and most settlers. But there are also people with a certain level of eccentricity and, yes, crazy, who come here because of that. They're here to escape the norms and rules of life down south. That can be a positive thing. They want something less rigid and more natural. Or their disregard for the rules of law is the reason they're happier here, where they can do whatever they want. That's going to mean, overall, a high quotient of
batshit crazy, as Ty said.
In every possible way. Ugh, the good and the bad. It's a world of extremes. It's like walking down a city street and winnowing out all the average people, the people who are happy enough going about their lives, the people who don't yearn for more, yearn for change, yearn for different. That's who we have here, long term. The dissatisfied and the dreamers and the doers and, unfortunately, the dangerous. Those who want to box up their superego and let their id run free. You get that down south, too. It's not as if people like Petra and Sebastian and Charisse and Matthias are some new species I never knew existed. I've met variations on all of them before. There's just a significantly higher concentration here.
Yeah.
As for Owen, I prompt. Dalton sighs and reaches for his canteen, taking a slug and then offering me some, which I accept.
Owen came to Rockton 5 years ago. I was deputy. And it was a little more than a year before Jean retired. Owen and I are about the same age, and that caused problems. He saw me as competition.
Dalton rolls his eyes.
By that time, I'd had my bad experience with a woman, so he was welcome to them. It's not like he'd have a problem anyway. When he showed up, they paid attention. He screwed around a bit, and then he set his sights on Isabel, which I couldn't figure out.
I sputter a laugh. Don't let her hear you say that.
Nah, she said it herself. I don't mean any insult. But she was 15 years older, and he had his pick of women, and it wasn't as if he knew her well enough to fall for her. He acted like a new stallion in a herd of mares, making his way through them. And when he came to Isabel, he figured he'd have a go and then move on. I mean, obviously, she'd be all over that, right? She wasn't, was she? Hell no. Isabel might have an eye for younger men, but she's never been hard up for attention. And she's a hell of a lot pickier than young and good-looking. When Isabel rejected him, she figured he'd sweep up his wounded pride and stalk off. He didn't. The more she said no, the more he wanted her. Pretty soon, she complained to Jean.
How'd that go? He shifts and makes a face.
I said this was shortly after my bad experience.
I know what he's talking about. When Dalton was young, he had plenty of women happy to introduce him to the joys of sex. He'd been in his late teens, and they'd been 5 to 10 years older, so everyone knew it was just fun. Then he reached his early 20s, and relationships became a possibility. He wasn't interested, and if the women were, he stepped away. Then he hit the one who didn't give up so easily.
It wasn't even one of my usual casual but committed relationships.
He continues.
We hooked up a couple of times, and she hinted at wanting more. Seeing the warning signs, I backed out as gently as I could.
She didn't take no for an answer. He nods.
At first, it was like she was trying to change my mind. But then, I'd come home, and she'd be in my kitchen, making dinner in her underwear. I'd be sleeping, and she'd slip into my bed. Hell, she walked into my shower once. Fucking scared the life out of me. First time I ever locked my doors.
Shit.
Yeah, it was bad. If another woman even talked to me, she'd get in their face. And it wasn't like I was trying to pick anyone up. We're talking conversations with women. Normal conversations.
What did you do?
Tried to handle it myself. When I couldn't, I asked other guys for advice. They laughed, told me I should take advantage. So I went to Jean. He didn't laugh, but he didn't see the problem either. Even my mother wasn't much better. She felt sorry for the woman who'd obviously fallen hard for me and said I should be more understanding. Maybe I should give her another chance. This woman is fucking up my life because she wants me back, so I should give in? Because fuck yeah, that's the kind of woman I want.
He shakes his head, and in his eyes there's old hurt, old pain, old anger. That's bullshit, I say.
Yep. But it happens to women all the time, doesn't it? That's what I realized. Jean was telling me that this woman wasn't a threat, wasn't actually hurting anyone, including me. She just liked me a lot, as if...
He waves his hands.
As if that's my fault, because I'm so irresistible.
I smile. I think you are. But yes, it's bullshit, and yes, women hear that all the time. He just likes you. You should give him a chance.
Exactly. I pulled my head out of my ass and realized that when women came to us with the same problem, we didn't do jack shit. If it wasn't assault, then it was just a guy trying to get sex.
Boys will be boys.
Right. And this is my very long way of explaining what happened with Owen and Isabel. Iz came to Jean with her complaint. Jean told her to be firmer with her refusals.
I snort a laugh.
Yeah.
Dalton says.
No one is firmer with her refusals than Isabel. So I tried to handle Owen and made an even bigger enemy in the process. I also realized this wasn't some guy being atypically aggressive with a woman. He had a past. He must. So I started digging. It was the first time I'd done that.
And?
First, I checked his reason for being here. As deputy, I didn't have access to that, but I knew where to get it. I discovered that he'd come here after an attempt on his life. He'd had a fling with a married woman, and the husband went after Owen, who narrowly escaped. The man vowed to finish the job. So Owen came to Rockton.
Uh-huh. Not exactly how it happened, is it?
No. And Jean should have looked at Isabel's complaint and at least wondered if there was more to Owen's story. He didn't. So I did some research when I went to Dawson. Turned out there was no fling, but not for lack of trying on Owen's part. He was stalking this woman, and her husband went after him because the police wouldn't. I also dug up his name as the defendant in a rape case, what they used to call date rape.
He wanted sex, and the women didn't, so he took it.
I'm not even sure if he asked. It was a college thing, a frat party. She said he put something in her drink. Denied it and said the sex was consensual. It never went to court. She dropped the case and dropped out of college, claiming harassment from Owen and his buddies.
Oh, I wish I could say I've never heard that story before.
Yeah. So the fact this asshole has turned his eye on you has me worried. Just because Charisse has the upper hand in the relationship doesn't mean Owen is harmless.
Thank you for telling me.
I'd never not tell you. As much as I hate making this place any scarier than it is.
I hug him. And he pulls me into his arms as we curl up for sleep. Chapter 29. We're asleep and I'm dreaming of Abby. Dreaming that she's lost in the woods and I hear her crying and I can't find her. I'm running through the forest, bottle in hand, thinking she's hungry and I need to feed her. I'm following her cries, and then she stops. Just stops. I startle awake. Storm whines, and I realize she was already up. She's still lying on the floor beside me, but she has her head raised, and she's whining deep in her throat. She smells or hears something. The cabin is silent and nearly dark, with just enough moonlight streaming in for me to see the outline of Storm's massive head. She glances my way, and I catch the gleam of her eyes. Another whine, sharper now. She rises with the huff of propelling her big body off the floor. Her nose nudges me, and I run my hand over her head as I listen for what woke her. A whisper of movement. That's what I catch. The soft sound of a foot in snow. Then another. A noise follows. A grunt? I think of bears. But even if one woke from hibernation, the sounds are too soft for that. They're too careful for that. Something is outside, and it is staying as quiet as it can. A bump startles me. It's a soft thud, someone bracing against the wall, trying to peer in the window. I glance at Dalton, but he's sound asleep. If I rouse him, however gently, he'll startle awake with enough noise to scare off whoever is out there. We're several hours' walk from Charisse's camp, and I can't imagine she'd have let Owen follow us. But they may have tracked us after sundown. Another bump against the wall, and I peer at the window. Storm whines again. She's rigid, staring at that wall, her tail sweeping the floor. It's not a happy wag. It's cautious. Uncertain. I slide out of bed and keep bent over beneath window level. I tug on jeans, a sweatshirt that turns out to be Dalton's, and my parka. Then I retrieve my gun. I glance at the bed again in hopes my moving around has brought Dalton closer to waking, but he's still dead to the world. I head for the door. Storm follows, nails clicking. I back up and tell her to stay, adding reassuring pats. She is not reassured. When I pull on my boots, her butt bobs off the floor. I consider. When Owen and Charisse first caught me, I'd wished Storm hadn't been there. She was a weakness they could use against me. Yet she may have saved my life. It's like Dalton with me. He'd love to tuck me away in a safe spot when danger strikes, but he knows I belong at his side, where we can look after each other. I need to start thinking the same with Storm. We trained her for work, and I have to let her do it, not play overprotective mom and tuck her away. I give the release sign, and when she comes over, I tell her to stay close and stay quiet. As I ease open the door, she's right beside me. We slip outside, and I pull the door shut behind us. There's a flashlight in my pocket, but I keep it there for now. I have my gun in hand instead as I look over the snow-covered field. It's a three-quarter moon on a cloudless night, and the light reflects off the snow, lifting the glade to soft daylight. I adjust my gun and glance at Storm. Her nose works madly, but she's still processing the danger, not ready to commit to a decision. We start along the wall, toward the spot where I'd heard the thumps. The squeak and crunch of snow announces our approach, and there's little I can do about that except keep my gun trained and my ears tuned for the sound of flight. Nothing comes. I reach the corner and duck before peering around with my face at a height any intruder won't expect. There's no one in sight. I ease around the side and check the back, in case the person ducked there. Nothing. Backing up, I look at the snow. It's trampled in a path from Cipher walking to his storage shed. I don't see any other trail. I bend to examine the prints. They all look to be from the same set of boots, which suggests they're Cipher's. But even as a prank, he'd never sneak around a cabin with two armed cops sleeping inside. I'm still bent when I see smaller prints leading from the forest and back again, and I'm leaning in for a closer look when Storm growls. I turn to find myself looking at a pale figure poised at the forest's edge. I'm on eye level with it, and our gazes lock. I tighten my grip on the gun and rise as slowly as I can while giving Storm the signal to stay where she is. She does, but she's growling, her hackles raised. The intruder isn't watching me now. He's looking straight at her. He takes a step our way, then another. Storm faints, obeying the order to stay while surging forward in warning. He stops, tilts his head, considers, and then cannot resist another careful step. It's the lone wolf from the other day. He's paying me no attention. I'm not the one he's here for, not the one he's curious about. He takes another step as he watches Storm. She makes a noise that starts as a growl, then switches to a whine before ending with a growl. She is curious too, as she was with the sled dogs. Curious, yet wary. She is no longer the pup who tore after a young cougar. She bears the scar from that encounter, and it has carved a path in her neural network, straight to her memories, as my scars do to mine. I lower my hand to pet her head as I murmur reassurances. The wolf is as tall as Storm, but she's significantly heavier, all thick muscle to his wiry frame. Between her size and my gun, she is safe. If she becomes distressed, we'll withdraw into the cabin. But it is safe to satisfy her curiosity. When I pet her, she is indeed reassured, and she relaxes. Both the whines and the growls subside, and she eyes the wolf, taking his measure. Then she puffs up in a way that makes me smile. She pulls herself straight and tall, displaying her full size. Her tail stays high, indicating welcome but not submission. Her head lifts and her ears relax. If she is nervous, she doesn't show it. She has assessed the wolf, declared him to be a lesser beast, and stands before him as a haughty queen, giving him permission to approach. With Rahul, Storm is the alpha. She's bigger and older, and so she is in charge. This wolf looks like a larger version of her packmate, and so she will not bow to him. The wolf continues his slow approach. When he's within a couple of feet, he stops, and the silence is broken by two canines sniffing the air madly. Then he stretches his muscle and their noses touch. As adorable as it is, I'm tensed for trouble. The mom assessing another child, still not convinced he doesn't pose a danger to her baby. While I have my gun, I'm also ready with my foot. I do not want to shoot a wolf for a show of dominance. I've dealt with enough stray dogs to know that a well-placed kick will allow us to retreat into the cabin. The wolf circles Storm, sniffing her. I instruct her to stay standing. Her head turns, though, following his progress. When he reaches her rear, he sticks his nose under her tail, and she jumps. He backs up only a second before returning, determinedly sniffing her there as he begins to whine and quake with obvious excitement. That's when I realize why this wolf has conquered his fear of humans to make his way here. Oh, I say, the word coming on a laugh. They both startle. Sorry, I murmur. The wolf tries sniffing under Storm's tail again, but she keeps it firmly down, and I have to chuckle at that. I also give her the release word. I'm not going to make her stand there, suffering the unwanted interest of this wolf. She turns to sniff him. He keeps trying for her tail, but she shoulders him aside and huffs. I tense. He accepts her annoyance, though, and lets her sniff him. Greetings over, she hunkers down, an invitation to play. He races around her, and she spins, ready to give chase, but he's only trying to get behind her again. Storm snaps and growls. and she issues the play invitation again. He seems to accept, and then swings behind and tries to mount her. I don't need to intercede. Storm yanks away, grabs him by the foreleg, and throws him down with a growl that very clearly says there will be none of that. Two more invitations to play only result in two more aborted mountings. Finally, she huffs her disgust at me, and I have to laugh. I know, I say. You want to be friends, and he's just looking to get laid. Some guys, huh? It's clear that the wolf really is only interested in one thing, and he's not getting it. Storm won't let him, and I wouldn't either. She retreats behind me, and I shoo him off with a, "Hey, hey!" as I lunge in his direction. As the wolf flees into the night, the cabin door bangs open, and I hear, "Shit! Casey!" I look around the corner to see Dalton staring at the retreating wolf. I say, "Did you forget something?" He looks down.
"Yep. Clothing, for one thing. Please get back inside before you lose any body parts I'd really rather you kept. I was, however, referring to..."
I lift my gun. "What were you gonna do? Punch the wolf in the nose?" He blinks, obviously still waking up. Then he says,
"Wouldn't be the first time. The last one was a feral dog, though."
"Back inside," I say. Storm and I follow Dalton. He's shivering, not surprisingly.
"Was that the same wolf?"
he says. "Yep. Remember how we were talking earlier about unwanted advances and guys who don't take no for an answer? It seems Storm has a suitor." He blinks, still bleary-eyed.
"What?"
"She must be coming into estrus," I say. "I haven't seen signs, but she's old enough." And that wolf picked up a scent that said if his advances weren't accepted right now, they might be soon.
Shit.
Yep. I know when we took her for her annual shots, the vet mentioned spaying, and we hadn't made a decision on that. We're going to need to. I crouch and hug Storm, running my hands over her as she trembles in lingering excitement from the encounter. As I pet her, I say, "Down south, spaying would be a no-brainer. No one needs more dogs. Here, though, I don't know. There could be some advantage to breeding her once. If we do want more working dogs in Rockton, we know she has good genes. On the other hand, we don't want every wolf and feral dog volunteering as puppy daddies."
"Is there some way to control her cycles?
Doggy birth control?" "I have no idea. More research for our next trip to Dawson." I give her one last pat as I stand. "At least one of us might be able to have babies, huh?" I say it lightly, but I feel Dalton's gaze on me. "I was kidding," I say.
"Kidding and not kidding."
He checks his watch.
"It's after 5, so I think we're up for good. If I put on the kettle for coffee, can we talk about this?"
I shrug. "Nothing to talk about, really. Yes, it's on my mind lately for obvious reasons, but talking is just treading the same ground over and over. Doesn't get me anywhere." He fixes me with that look, trying to extract from my brain the answers I'm not giving. Then he puts the blackened kettle directly on the fire. "You need to teach Ty how to set that up properly," I say.
"Guy drinks instant coffee with powdered creamer. I don't think he cares whether he's heating the water right."
He backs from the fire and pulls on his sweatpants. He's still adjusting them, not looking at me, when he says,
"You had so much other shit to deal with after the beating. Just getting up and around again, then getting your strength back, getting on the police force. All the things they said you couldn't do. And you did. This other thing was..."
He struggles for words.
"It's an injury to a muscle you weren't sure you'd ever want to use. Except it's more than just a muscle that doesn't work. It's something they took from you, on top of all the rest. Something you can't fix through sheer determination and hard work."
Tears roll down my cheeks. I don't even realize it until he reaches for me. He has put into words everything I've been feeling these last few days. And it's as if I've said them myself, but better, because I didn't have to. 14 years ago, 4 men beat me and left me for dead. They took my mobility, leaving me with a leg injury that doctors said meant I'd never run again. They left me with scars, physical and psychological, that people said meant I'd never become a cop. They took my pride, too, and my dignity and my self-confidence. But I triumphed because I fought back in the way that really counted. I can run. I am a cop. And while there's still psychological damage, in regaining my mobility and achieving my career goal, I won back my pride and my dignity and my self-confidence. Wherever those four thugs are now, I have a better life than they do. I'm sure of it. So I won. Except now, as Dalton says, there's this one thing they took that I cannot regain. It didn't matter before because I never saw myself as a mother. I had an all-consuming career and no interest in long-term relationships. Being with Dalton changed both those things and nudged that old scab. Then came Abby, and seeing Dalton with her and feeling my own reaction to her has ripped that scab clear off, and it hurts. It hurts so much. Tied up in that pain is rage. Those men did take something from me, something I cannot get back. And here is this life choice that I'm not even sure I want, but I should damned well have that option. I don't, and it is their fault. I say all this to Dalton. The kettle boils and it boils and I'm still talking, the words rushing out. And finally, there's nothing more to say. Then I take the kettle and pour the coffees, brushing him off when he tries to help. I measure in the creamer with such care you'd think it was powdered gold. Then I stir, slowly and deliberately, giving myself time to recover.
There are options,
he says.
If that's what you want.
I'm not sure it is. I have no idea right now and no time to sit and think about it. There's no point either. If we don't find Abby's family, then she's one option. And I'd do that before I'd even try carrying a baby to term myself. If we do find her family, then I need to figure out whether what I'm feeling is just a surge of maternal instinct. Then you and I need to talk about it. Either way, and I wave my hands. Oh, part of me wants to consider options, and another part says that's like deciding which university to send your kid to before she's even born. Dalton settles onto the bed with his coffee and motions for me to sit beside him. I do, and Storm moves to lie across our feet.
So,
Dalton says,
you know that the council has threatened to kick me out of Rockton. Even when they don't say it, I feel the weight of that hammer over my head. This woman, who is very smart, once told me that the best way to cope with that is to figure out a game plan. What I'd do if it happened.
I never said it was the best way, just one way. He waves off the distinction.
The point is that my brain works like hers does. We need solid footing. I need to know that if I get kicked out, I have a plan. So I'm going to suggest that she needs the same thing. A plan for what we'd do if we ever decide we want one of those wrinkly things that screams for us to feed her and screams for us to change her shitty diaper and won't let us sleep more than 3 hours at a stretch.
You make it sound so enticing.
I know. But in spite of their unbelievably selfish behavior, I will admit that I do see an appeal to babies that I never did before. Which is not to say that I want one. If we don't find Abby's parents, then I would seriously consider it and lean toward yes. Otherwise, I'd back up to just seriously considering it for some point in the future.
Agreed.
So let's jump past Abby and jump past the soul searching and decide on a plan of action. Should the answer be yes, we want kids. How would we do that?
I exhale. Okay, well, the problem, according to the doctors, isn't whether I could get pregnant, but whether I could carry to term. I would try, but it's not like taking endless shots on a basketball net, waiting to sink one. Trying and failing would be
traumatic.
When I make a face, he shakes his head and says,
My mom, my birth mother, lost a couple of pregnancies after Jacob, and I might have been young, but I remember it was really hard on them. So that's an option, but with a limited number of trials.
I nod.
And if those trials put you in danger, would I have the right to say stop?
He asks. You would.
Good. Next option.
I go quiet for a moment. Then I say, adoption is the most obvious. Maybe even the best to start with, but it's not easy getting a baby. Even if we could.
You'd prefer your own. Our biological child.
I'm about to shake my head. Then I pause to consider it more. All other things being equal? Yes, I suppose I would, as selfish as that is. But I'd take another baby in a heartbeat. Having our biological child isn't that important, it's just... I squirm and his arm slides around my waist. I continue. I would worry that, given your situation, even if you felt okay with adoption, you might have misgivings later. What if it's a very young mother who later regretted her decision? What if the child grew up wanting answers, wanting his or her biological family? That's probably natural at some point, but I think it would be difficult for you. He opens his mouth, and I can tell he's ready to deny it. Then he pauses, like me, to consider before he says,
I would like to think I'd be fine. I do see your point, though, and it wouldn't be fair to a kid if I brought my baggage into parenthood. However, if adoption is the best option, I'd be fine. I'd make sure I was.
The other is surrogacy, I say. He frowns, and I explain.
So we rent a womb?
He says. I sputter a laugh. It's a little more complicated, but yes, that's the basic idea.
Okay,
he says, nodding.
So that's the plan, then, if we ever reach that stage. Try ourselves, and if that doesn't work or it endangers you, then option two is surrogacy. Option three is adoption.
He looks at me.
Does that help?
It feels a little silly, coming up with a course of action for something we may never want, but...
It's never silly if it makes you feel better.
I lean over to kiss him. It does. Thank you. Chapter 30. We set off after a world-class breakfast of instant coffee, protein bars, and venison jerky. Then we walk all morning in snowshoes, carrying provisions on our backs, stopping only to dine on water, half a protein bar, and a slab of venison jerky. I can grumble about the menu, but by lunch, I'm like a starving cartoon character, spotting shy Arctic hares and seeing only their plump bodies roasting on a spit. Off again. And it's mid-afternoon before Dalton slows to examine landmarks, like reaching the right neighborhood and slowing the car to read street signs. Storm whines and we go still, listening. When we hear the crunch of snow, he calls.
Hello?
The footsteps stop.
I'm letting you know we're here,
Dalton says.
We're armed and we have a dog. That's not a threat. Again, just letting you know so we don't give you a scare. We're restraining the dog and lowering our weapons. We'd like to speak to you, please.
Silence. Dalton grunts as if to say he hoped it'd be that easy but knew better. Still, he tries again, with,
My name is Eric Dalton. I know the second settlement is out here and we found something in the forest that we're told might belong to you. We only want to return it.
More silence. Dalton grumbles now, but I catch the faintest whisper of fabric. I touch Dalton's arm and direct his attention left, where a figure stands in shadow, watching us as cautiously as any wild beast. It's a young man, late teens, maybe 20. He carries a bow, but it's lowered, and he's just watching, reminding me of that wolf the day before. Hello, I resist the urge to say we come in peace, though I doubt this young man would get the reference. We just need to speak to someone from the second settlement. My name's Casey. This is Eric. He keeps watching us with wary curiosity. And this is Storm, I say, nodding down. She's a dog, not a bear. I smile. She gets that mistake a lot. No reaction. I'm holding her by the collar, I say. She's big, but she's friendly if you want to come closer. He doesn't move.
May we speak to you from there? I ask.
When he stays silent, I'm beginning to wonder if he understands English. Then he says,
Yes. Before we do,
Dalton drawls,
I'd appreciate knowing if we need to watch for anyone jumping at our backs. I'm sure you aren't out here alone.
Silence. And even from here, I swear I see the boy considering. Finally, he says,
The others are close. They'll come if I call them. Fair enough,
Dalton says. I'm going to remove my pack, I say. I'm getting something out that I want to show you. I take the remaining piece of Ellen's parka from my bag and hold it out. We're told this was made by someone in the second settlement. He squints. Then he eases forward until he's about 5 feet away. He reaches out, and I pass him the material. He peers at it and then shakes his head as he returns it.
It's not ours. You sure?
Dalton asks. The young man's eyes flash.
I know the work of my people. I don't know what you found, but if that was what led you to think it's ours, then someone has made a mistake. Or someone is trying to cause trouble for us. We don't want the kind of trouble that comes with you.
Me? Dalton says.
Who am I?
It's not who you are, it's where you're from.
His gaze travels meaningfully over Dalton's clothing.
Rockton. My people separated from yours, and we ask only to be left alone.
And you're not missing anything? I ask. Missing anyone?
No, we are not. You sure?
Dalton says again. He gets that same flash of annoyance, stronger now.
If we were missing a person, I'd be out here hunting for him.
Maybe you are,
Dalton says.
Then I'd be more interested when you said you found something of ours, wouldn't I? We have no quarrel with Rockton. If we had someone missing, we'd be grateful for your help.
If we found one of yours, we would return him.
Despite those flashing eyes, the young man keeps his voice calm. He's well-spoken, polite. I get a distinctly different vibe from him than I do from the first settlement. There's no challenge here. We're just two groups occupying the same region, and this one would rather keep those lines of separation clear. Like an introvert neighbor who thinks it's very nice that you're throwing a barbecue and hopes it goes well, but doesn't want to attend, and would politely request that you stop asking.
You have any idea where this came from?
Dalton says, pointing at the fabric.
No, and if I did, I would tell you.
All right. We'll keep looking then.
The young man nods and withdraws without another word. We watch him go. Then Dalton says,
You buy that?
He seems sincere, but Ty was certain he knew where it came from. That kid really doesn't want us getting closer to their settlement. I'm not ready to drop this on his say-so.
Agreed.
We follow the young man at a distance. According to Dalton, he's heading toward the settlement, moving quickly, too. We start closing the gap between us. It's better to catch up with him on the outskirts where it's too late to blow us off again, yet it's clear we aren't trying to ambush his settlement. I spot smoke rising over the trees ahead when Dalton grasps my arm. His hand drops to his gun, and I pull mine. Dalton pivots.
Step out! There's a gun trained on each of you!
His gaze flicks in the other direction, and I turn that way, my gun rising. Silence.
Look,
Dalton says.
I don't want to pull this shit. We're walking to your village. We talked to a kid from it, but we need more information, and he didn't seem the right person to give it. We appreciate your caution, but our guns do a hell of a lot more damage than your bows, and they work a hell of a lot faster. Also, you're making our dog nervous.
As if on cue, Storm growls.
Just step out, please,
Dalton says,
and we'll all lower our weapons and talk.
No answer.
Fuck,
Dalton grumbles. He turns to me and says, loud enough for them to hear,
Don't you just get tired of this shit?
I do.
Do people pull this crap down south?
No, but we have cell phones. We can call before we show up.
That's what we need. Cell phones. Can we get a few of those?
Sure. First, you need a cell tower.
Fuck.
Or we could do it the old-fashioned way, I say. Ring their doorbell.
Hell yeah!
He raises his voice more.
You guys got a doorbell? No? How's this?
He raps his knuckles on the nearest tree.
Sheriff Eric Dalton of Rockton calling with my wife, Detective Casey Butler, also of Rockton. May we come in?
A man appears from Dalton's direction, shaking his head.
I suppose you're trying to be funny,
he says, no rancor in his voice.
Yeah,
Dalton says.
I'd make a better asshole than a comedian, but I'm trying a new tactic.
The man's lips quirk as he walks over.
I want to keep working at it, but I appreciate the effort.
He's in his mid-40s, a tall, rangy man with weathered skin. His dark-haired and round face and his countenance reminds me of the young man's. A relative, I'd guess. The other man comes into view but stops short as he sees me.
Tomas? Yes,
the older man replies.
You get a look at the girl? She's not from Rockton. She's Edwin's.
Tomas turns his gaze on me and frowns. He takes in my clothing. Then he looks at the other man.
Just because she's partly Asian does not mean she's related to the only Asian person you've met.
I'm not, I say. I know Edwin, but I'm no more likely to share ancestry with him than with you. I glance at Dalton, or with him, which would be really awkward. Tomas chuckles. The other man's eyes stay narrowed in suspicion. Tomas stretches his hand to me and then to Dalton. We shake it. The other man stays where he is. We met a young man a few minutes ago, I say to Tomas. Maybe late teens? He bore a resemblance to you. Your son?
Nephew,
Tomas says.
But my wife and I have been raising him the last few years. We saw you tracking him and got concerned.
I apologize for that, I say. We have some questions. We found a, I hesitate. A body. A woman dressed in clothing that we were told came from the second settlement. But your nephew didn't recognize it. He said no one's missing, and he obviously wanted to leave it at that, but we need to find out where she belonged. Even if she's not yours, any help would be appreciated. I understand you prefer not to have contact with Rockton. Tomas says with a shrug.
We're not exactly hiding behind a wall with archers and a moat. We do keep to ourselves, but we'd like to help you find this poor woman's people. That's only right.
The other man snorts and stalks off. Tomas shakes his head with a wry smile.
Well, not everyone here will be so helpful. They won't object to me speaking to you.
Thank you. I take the scrap from my pocket. The person who sent us to you had a long-standing trade relationship with your settlement, and he was convinced someone there, maybe someone who used to live there, did the craftsmanship.
How is Tyrone?
Tomas asks. And I must look surprised because he laughs.
Not many people have had that long-standing trade relationship you mentioned. Tyrone was sheriff when my brother and I left Rockton, and I advocated for trade with him when he left himself. We had a change in leadership a few years ago, and
he shrugs.
Tyrone Cipher is an unusual man. He made our current leader nervous, and she decided to cut ties.
Ty's fine, thank you, I say. And yes, he's the only one who recognized this. I hold out the piece. The man frowns. He takes it and examines it, his frown growing. You don't recognize it? I ask.
No, I certainly do. I was just wondering why Lane, my nephew, told you otherwise. But I shouldn't wonder, really. People here can be very secretive, and my brother always had a touch of paranoia, which is how the two of us ended up in Rockton in the first place. I apologize for Lane. They didn't mean any harm. Yes, I definitely recognize this, because it's my work. Well, the leather work is mine. The decorating is my wife's.
He smiles, his eyes warming.
She's the artist. I just try to provide a canvas halfway worthy of her art.
It is gorgeous work, I say.
But you mentioned that you found it on a dead woman. No one's missing from our village. While we do trade with former members, no one has left in years. And the only woman we actually trade with.
He trails off and he blinks. When he speaks, his throat dries up and he has to try twice before he says,
Could you describe this woman?
Are you familiar with the hostels? He pales, then he forces a ragged laugh.
Haven't heard that word in a very long time. We call them the wild people. But yes, it's hard to live out here and not know them, as much as we might wish otherwise. This woman, he swallows. You asked that for a reason, didn't you?
I did.
Ellen, he murmurs.
I nod. That was apparently her name. I take out the leather anklet she'd worn. When I pass it over, he stares at it and sways just a little. His eyes squeeze shut and he nods, as if to himself, and says in a small voice,
How did it happen?
She was shot, I say. He flinches. Then he says slowly,
And this sheriff is the truth of your earlier words. Why your guns are so much more dangerous than our bows. Yes, it is possible to accidentally shoot someone while hunting, but the chances of killing them are slight. We always hope that the scarcity of ammunition will decrease the use of firearms in these woods, but...
His gaze rises to Dalton's, meeting it.
That will not happen while Rockton has guns and ammunition, and the willingness to trade both.
My brows rise. Dalton says to me,
Yeah, under Tyrone, Rockton traded ammunition to help those who chose to leave, giving them a higher chance of survival. Of course, another philosophy is that if you don't trade, maybe they'll see the light and come back. That's what Gene thought. By the time he left, people had found other sources of ammo, and I'm sure as hell not giving them extra.
He looks at Tomas.
I'd supply it in a matter of life or death. I'm not gonna let anyone starve, but personally, I'm on your side. I'd like to see a lot fewer guns. Fuck, I'd make our own residents use bows if that didn't mean we'd be facing settlers and traders and miners with guns. Rockton hasn't supplied weapons or ammunition in years, and though you haven't suggested it outright, we didn't kill this woman. We found her on a camping trip.
Tomas nods.
I wasn't accusing you, but thank you for clarifying. I'm guessing that's how it happened? A hunting accident?
It's difficult to tell, I say. The reason we're pursuing it is that she had something with her. Something that may be important to someone. I still want the chance to evaluate Abby's parents before I return her. I know I may not have that right. Yet after meeting Owen and Charisse, I will place myself in this role, judging who does and does not deserve their child back. If I need to justify that, I'll do it with the reminder that Ellen could have rescued Abby from abandonment. If her parents were from the second settlement and hid the pregnancy, they won't want their fellow settlers knowing what they did. If the second settlement was complicit in the abandonment, they won't want her back. Either way, the settlement might lie and take the child to save face. When I say this, being cagey, Tomas's gaze drops to the bracelet, still in his hands. Not that, I say. If anyone in the settlement knew Ellen well, we'd love the chance to speak to them. I'm trying to piece together her final days. The corners of his lips rise in a strained smile.
You really are a detective, then?
I am.
Well,
he trails off, and I can see him thinking, considering his options. Finally, he says,
My wife was close to Ellen. They were friends. I would appreciate the chance to speak to Nancy, my wife, first, if you don't mind. I'd like this news to come from me.
We understand.
I'll go into the settlement and tell people what has happened. They won't be thrilled at you being here, but with a death involved, they will understand. Many were fond of Ellen. This will be difficult.
I nod. He starts to leave. Then he looks down at the bracelet. He stares at it a moment before clearing his throat, his expression unreadable as he says,
May I ask?
Another glance at the bracelet.
I'd rather not show this to anyone yet. It was, very personal.
Dalton and I exchange a glance.
I agree, and Tomas pockets the bracelet before heading toward the village. Chapter 31. It takes a while for Tomas to return, but we expect that. We take off our snowshoes and packs, drink some water, share another protein bar, and play with Storm. Or Dalton plays with her. I lie on my back in the snow. Just making snow angels, really. Not collapsed from the exhaustion of snowshoeing all day. When Tomas returns, he's alone, and I'm braced for,
"Sorry, but you can't come in."
But he waves for us to follow. After a few steps, he says,
"Nancy is